we are in a global race for innovation. And if we do not prepare, and we can't wait for kids to graduate high school and college, we need that work now.
From Washington, D.C., this is The Tightrope. I'm your host, Dan Smolin. Our mission on this podcast is to help you realize your dreams of doing meaningful work. Here you'll meet and be inspired by amazing people who overcame great odds. You'll discover what sparked them, how they explored work opportunities, the strategies that they employed to ensure career success, and the actions they boldly took to make it all happen. You'll also meet esteemed and nationally recognized thought leaders who are helping people like you to develop work skill, experience, and leadership, and seize opportunity from a changing world so that your beautiful work dreams turn into reality. Together, let's turn work meaningful, for meaningful work is the future of work. The city of Bridgeport, the second largest in the state of Connecticut, was once an industrial powerhouse. Fueled by New Deal-era federal investment, Bridgeport became home to companies that supported our armed services during World War II. After the war and through the mid-1960s, Bridgeport needed so much skilled labor that people arrived from across the U.S. and Puerto Rico to live and work there. But in the 1970s, Bridgeport fell into despair. Companies left town and took most of the skilled jobs with them. Whole blocks of the city's industrial center closed down and high unemployment followed. And adding insult to injury, Bridgeport lost a thriving downtown where new businesses could start up and restaurants and other attractions could drive a civic renaissance. In their book, Healing American Democracy, Going Local, authors Mike Hayes, Doug Ross, and Morley Winograd describe how constitutional localism is moving decision-making and governing authority away from Washington to our cities. The result? Our localities are beginning to thrive. Businesses are succeeding where, for decades, many had previously failed. Best of all, cities and small communities are becoming places where people want to live and do meaningful work. We discussed localism with Doug Ross and Morley Winograd, and in a segment not previously streamed, they describe how Bridgeport is one of many U.S. cities that is going local to again make the city an attractive place to live and work. We also meet a young entrepreneur who has her own take on Bridgeport's efforts at driving localism. Career counselor and business owner Natalie Price describes some of the challenges the city continues to face for it to again be a thriving and scaling business and residential community. First up, we hear from Doug Ross and Morley Winograd from an interview recorded over Skype in September 2018. Now, let's talk about Bridgeport because you guys write about Bridgeport in your book. What's happening there that gives you pause for hope?
What we talk about in the book is this formation of a millennial generation of civic engagement and civic leadership. It's out here in San Bernardino, California, Generation Now. It's Generation Now in Bridgeport, Connecticut as well. The two cities couldn't be more different in terms of the external environment. But in both cases, and we expect in many more in the future, you're going to see these kinds of millennial-driven civic renewals. And the way they're going to do that renewal, even as challenging as it might be in Bridgeport, is not by using the old formula, well, let's go ask the federal government to give us money because we don't have any resources. It's instead going to say, okay, let's start with the resources we have. Why do we live here? What do we like about living here? What are the assets of the place we're in? Why do our friends and colleagues and generational peers, what do they do for entertainment and employment? What do they want to do? What would they like to see changed? How can we create a governing structure that's focused here and not elsewhere or up? And therefore, they get very civically engaged. They get involved in who's on the city council, who's on the school board, how's the police department functioning, what are we doing to fix the roads and fix our schools. It's all local stuff. And by saying we can do it ourselves, that we don't need help from the outside, we will find the resources and the capacity for it here, they begin to transform this old 20th century hulk of a place that they inhabit into one that is adapted to 21st century circumstances.
And I'd add, if you look at a number of the cities that have come back, that's primarily how they've done it. Sometimes federal resources have been involved, but it's a much more honest answer to a region that has become economically obsolete than to somehow promise we'll rescue you from Washington. Nobody really gets rescued from Washington. It's about saying, as Morley said, if we want to stay here, if we value living here, we're going to have to figure out a new path forward. That's been hard for people to say politically, because particularly you're running for Congress, you want to say, I will fix it from there. But if you really want to change the community in which you live, we're finding that taking it up yourself is the most promising way forward.
And you live that every day in Detroit, right, Doug? You see it in the differences
absolutely.
In the city that you've lived in all your life.
Right, absolutely.
Well, I hope Bridgeport can catch up with Detroit in that respect. You know, one problem that Connecticut has, Connecticut is so bifurcated between haves and have-nots, and Bridgeport is a have-not place with a very expensive, what they call a mill rate. It's the local tax rate, which is very expensive in the cities. And I guess my question is, how would a renaissance work in a place like Bridgeport that is so expensive to live in from the standpoint of what a homeowner or a city dweller has to pay in taxes? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I'll go back to the example that Doug gave earlier of a local idea that spread across the country. The reason the Kalamazoo, Michigan civic leadership decided to make college tuition free for anybody who attended Kalamazoo Public Schools was to make that promise the heart of an economic development strategy. The city government, as places like Bridgeport would do, came to those who might influence and have the money to influence the outcome of a millage election, of what you called it, a mill rate. They wanted to raise the taxes because they were facing a civic, a governmental decline in revenues. People were abandoning the school district. They weren't getting the money they used to get from the state for each person enrolled because there were fewer people enrolled. So they were basically in a downward spiral of central industries of Kalamazoo having left, which were originally drug companies. And so they came to them and they said, you know, actually that won't work. If your solution is to raise taxes, you're only going to accelerate the problem. People will further flee the city because it'll be too expensive, even more expensive rather, and it'll have even less services and less of a school district. Why don't we find something that would attract people to the city instead? And so they came up with this idea, and they put their money where their mouth is. These folks funded the first Promise program in America on a personal basis as a philanthropic venture. It's not the way it's done most of the time now. But they basically said anybody who attends Kalamazoo Public Schools can go to any college in Michigan tuition-free, and if you go for all 12 years, it will be, in fact, tuition-free. And, of course, what happened was housing started to be built in Kalamazoo. People started coming back to live there. You used to drive down the streets and see a for-sale sign that said Kalamazoo Promise Entitled, and which meant that you could get the college, your kids' college tuition-free, if you're willing to come in and pay the existing taxes. It's that kind of innovative social innovation thinking that's going to be required. It didn't depend upon any national resource whatsoever, even though, you know, there's a dozen states with free college tuition now in over 200 communities. And it's a hot topic even in Connecticut, where there's been bills introduced to try and create free college tuition. But the idea was, let's figure out something that would attract people instead of figuring out a new way to pay for what is, let's create something new.
Now we hear Natalie Price's take on Bridgeport and its localism efforts in an excerpt from a full interview, which will stream on the tightrope in March 2020. We spoke to Natalie from her office via Skype in November 2019.
So I get nervous because I understand that we are working with a lot of K-12 initiatives, mm-hmm. but I know that there's an immediate generation that needs help now. And if we decide to look at this as a whole United States thing, we are in a global race for innovation. And if we do not prepare, and we can't wait for kids to graduate high school and college, we need that work now. And it's great because I'm really looking at like the New Deal and when it was written, and what it, in the time it was written during a crisis during the early 20th century, right? We were going through the Great Depression. The economy was at a halt. So we needed to do something to pump the economy, get it going again. So we did the New Deal, came out in phases. And the first phase was allowed federal dollars to come into communities like Bridgeport,
right,
and fund certain projects. And people were able to get work off of that, right? And if you were a skilled worker, you got paid $1.20. And if you were unskilled, you got 50 cents. People came from all over the country to Bridgeport to be able to get work just because of that New Deal, right?
Mm-hmm.
The New Deal funded trainings. It even funded some housing initiatives so that people can have their owning property to drive taxes in certain areas. We need a better deal. And we need a new, we need to do it over and we need a better deal.
So you talk about Bridgeport and the New Deal. So I'll give you some historical perspective, and the listeners probably know by now because I talk about it a lot. I'm from New Haven, 20 miles east up I-95 from Bridgeport. So throughout the 1900s, the 20th century, Bridgeport was a major manufacturing center. The New Deal actually poured a lot of money into Southern Connecticut, and in particular places like Bridgeport, so that when World War II broke out, there was such a need for talent, for people to work in Bridgeport, that immigrants came from Puerto Rico and people from the Deep South migrated up to Connecticut to take on these jobs. Well, we fast forward from the 1940s to the late 1960s, early 1970s, and whole blocks of Bridgeport start shuttering down. Jobs go away. Unemployment goes up. That old thing that built Bridgeport suddenly isn't working anymore. And the need for Washington to fund enterprise wasn't working. And places like Bridgeport, which were built to drive industry, suddenly foundered. So you're in a laboratory right now, 2019. Bridgeport's trying to come back, and you talk about a new kind of New Deal. Bridgeport's been illustrated as a place where a new kind of New Deal called localism is happening, whereby the city is realizing that it needs to bootstrap a little and create innovation from within and not necessarily from Washington. You've had a front row seat to this, and I'm wondering if you can describe how Bridgeport is faring through all of that.
So I think that in terms of business in Bridgeport and what's happening, I think that business doesn't thrive if there's not enough traffic, right? So we have a downtown, but we don't have enough traffic in the downtown, right? There's not a balance. There's not a really a good balance of retail and restaurants.
Right.
We are just starting to get people moving down here, but we would need a lot more people down here to see that bump and chat feel that we need.
Mm.
I call it like the New York City feel,
mm-hmm.
or even the New Haven feel at that, right?
Right, right.
It doesn't have to be that. But I also think that there's infrastructure issues mm-hmm. that prevent some of that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So we have sidewalks that kind of need to be repaired.
Mm-hmm.
We need kind of like better lighting in certain areas. Not that it's not being worked on, but there could be areas improvement. We can open up a business, but if there's no one there to patronize, the business closes. And that's what we're just seeing right now. I honestly don't know the state of what the direction that Bridgeport is going as a whole. I know what Natalie is doing in her part to be mm-hmm. able to move some initiatives forward. But as much as I respect the idea of localism,
mm-hmm.
I do believe that localism works also when leadership is in sync.
Yes.
Right? So, and our leadership is just not in sync. And this is what we're going to be dealing with. And so that just makes me, as an entrepreneur who has put a lot of skin in the game,
mm-hmm.
makes me say, okay, so all this work I've put into this, how do I still get the benefit out of it? And to me, I just stay committed and consistent, right? That's never failed me. That has never failed me. as long as I am committed and consistent. And committed doesn't mean that I'm giving my all to something. Committed means that I'm going to start this project. I'll make sure it has the right support that it needs to be able to work in the way that it needs to work to be effective. But in the meanwhile, there are other opportunities that may not be Bridgeport related that I'm interested in. And I think that's the way sometimes that we have to think.
Well, you mentioned New Haven. So the similarities between New Haven and Bridgeport is both cities used to have big downtown malls where people congregated. Both those cities no longer have malls. The difference is that in New Haven, you have Yale University pumping dollars into the city's economy through people, and people are there and they want a good place to dine out or buy something interesting. Bridgeport, once Lafayette Mall closed down, I want to say in the early 1990s, I don't remember there being a downtown, so that's a big disadvantage. Now, from my perspective, and I'm listening to what you're saying, Natalie, I think where some of the localistic impacts could actually happen is perhaps through things like a maker movement, where people make stuff, bespoke things, tools, processes, merchandise, and they do it locally and they build a reputation for it. And I'm wondering if you're seeing any of that happen in your city.
Well, I guess I would say yes, because I do own a store called the Collab Exchange, which we house local entrepreneurs that are making and creating their own brand to be able to have a space to sell their merchandise. So I am seeing it definitely seeing it on a local level. Mm-hmm. I just think that the stability of it is my concern, right? Mm-hmm. So how do we keep it that it's lasting? And that means like the person that is making these organic candles, how do I make sure that she can turn this really into a viable business and that it's lasting? And that can't happen unless I really give her the true resources of having a space, but also giving her the resource of knowing you need a strong online presence to be able to sell your product.
Right.
And that's just the reality. See, what I don't want to do is give people this false hope of, oh, we're going right back to what we used to be. Do you remember when Facebook and the .com era started and nobody believed it?
Right.
We can't live like that anymore. We have to pay attention to the conditions emerging and immediate that are happening around us. An immediate condition is that Amazon is opening a warehouse 10 miles from me, and Amazon is taking over a market of online retail. That is an immediate thing happening. And how do I get people that I'm coaching, that I'm working with, that have products, to be able to understand that reality so that they're prepared to get into it? We can no longer make entrepreneurship sound like this fairy tale. And the reason why is because it's now becoming the career.
Well, I think one thing that has changed is the idea of scale.
Yes.
The old idea of entrepreneurism was scale, that you wanted to have what they used to call a hockey stick, that at some point revenue went up rather than down, but did so consistently. I think the idea of scale now, and the reason why I was asking about localism, is that I actually see some evidence that the idea of scale is changing to something that is smaller, because smaller is often more attainable. Or should I say attainable? Maybe a company that grows can do so with 10 people and not have to hire 100 people. And maybe that's better for some companies, not all, but maybe some. I think Amazon has freaked out a lot of people. Hey, down here in the DC area, they're taking over Crystal City, Virginia. And a lot of small businesses are going to be threatened by business rents that are going up. Cost of living is going to spike. This big monolith is moving in. They're going to hire 25,000 people, many of whom are going to be high-tech trained. So those salaries are going to be, starting at $150,000, maybe going higher. What happens to the small business owner who was in Crystal City, Virginia prior?
We have to figure out how our local municipalities redo charters that protect small businesses, like create small business zones that cannot be touched by big entities like that.
Mm.
So what I realize is that we have to really rethink everything. We have to say this is a blank canvas, and we have to rethink how we are going to live, because we have a lot of major disruptions that will continue to happen, especially as technology continues to get better.
Right.
It's going to get faster and faster. We're just going to be disrupting things out, right? So how do we protect small business owners, right? So if Amazon is coming here, how do we protect, make sure that the funds that they get fund small business projects,
mm-hmm.
right? So maybe they do get a local tax, and then there's a small business tax that they have to pay. Like, we could create that in our local municipalities or states, because we already know that they pay a little bit to nothing in federal tax.
Right.
So what can we know? You know what? You're going to be here. There needs to be a transportation tax. There's going to be a lot of people hustling and bustling through our city. These roads are going to need to be taken care of. These are just ideas.
Thanks to Doug Ross, Morley Winograd, and Natalie Price for walking the tightrope with us. Links to the Healing American Democracy Going Local book page on Amazon and Natalie's social media are provided in the show notes for this episode. Our success is your success. But we cannot build our community without your help and support. So if you haven't done so already, please join the Dan Smolin Experience to get our newsletter offering information, tips, and hacks to help you succeed in doing meaningful work. To sign up, simply click the Subscribe to the Dan Smolin Experience newsletter button on our homepage at dansmolin.com. Fill out the short form, then click the Subscribe button at the bottom of the page, and you'll be on your way. Also, become a regular listener of the Tightrope with Dan Smolin podcast. You can easily find current and past episodes by keywording the Tightrope with Dan Smolin at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, on our website at dansmolin.com, or wherever you choose to listen. And don't forget to show your support on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and Twitter. You can locate our social media buttons at the upper right corner of our webpages at dansmolin.com. From Washington, D.C., this is The Tightrope. I'm your host, Dan Smolin. And do remember this, our best days lie ahead. Have a great and successful week, everyone.